The following podcast is a Super Network production with your hosts, Super Marcy.
The main character of Plug is dirty and disgusting, and there's a scene in this film and you see he's got his big mutton chops, he's wearing a hat, he's making these grunting sounds.
The terrible Australian, Bea Jamine.
Marcy, there's a scene for poor Barry McKenzie where French police shoot up an entire box of Foster's beer with machine guns.
It contains coarse and explicit language.
Absolutely nothing. There's nothing there. This is This is a hole of a movie.
Mature themes.
I knew it was going to be a documentary about sex, but I thought it would be more about love and relationships and stuff like that. I didn't realize it was going to be about venereal diseases.
And potential spoilers.
Spoiler alert.
For more, please visit supermarcy.com and show your support at patreon.com/thesupernetwork. Enjoy the show.
G'day everyone, this is Bea Jamine, aka The Terrible Aussie, and welcome back to episode 14 of the Ozploitcast, the podcast where my co-host Super Marcy and I take a deep dive into Australia's Ozploitation movement from the very beginning in the 70s right up until today. And with me, as always, is my very Aussie co-host, the one, the only, Super Marcy. Hello, Marcy. How are you?
Hello, hello. I'm glad that this episode, I'm very Aussie. I definitely feel just super Aussie right now.
Indeed, indeed. At least at the time of this recording, the Actor Awards are going to be happening later tonight. So it's kind of a funny thing to record on the day when that happens. Hence why this is the most... one of the most Aussie podcasts out there, but that's beside the point. However, Marcy, we are not alone on this podcast. We have someone who is making his debut appearance on this show, and he's also hosts a very Aussie podcast as well. And he is the host of the awesome podcast, A Dingo Ate My Movie. And that, of course, is Pete. Hello, Pete, and welcome to be... the Ozploitcast.
I've been on that one, I think.
Yes.
Thank you. It's great to be here. It's excellent to be here. It's great to be with you both. I think we've both had you guys separately on my other show, on my show, which is great. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's great being on each other's shows. It's excellent.
Oh, definitely, definitely. And also for the fact, Peter, unlike us, you with your show and Dingo Ate My Movie, you just pick any type of Aussie film that for your show, like in terms of which one you would like to discuss. However, Marcy and I are just doing the entire Ozploitation movement from the very beginning to end, five films per episode, and we definitely covered quite a lot of ground in terms of this show.
It's tough work. I don't know how you do it. Five at every, you know, I do singles. I've just recorded one episode that's a double, but yeah, it's...
I don't know how I manage, but somehow we do. And somehow I remember the movies that we've watched, whether I liked them or not.
Indeed, indeed, indeed. But I'm very excited for this episode, particularly with you as our guest for this one, Pete, because we have five very different Ozploitation films that we're going to be discussing for this episode. And the films that we're going to be talking about on this episode are Dead Easy, The Killing of Angel Street, Goodbye Paradise, Running on Empty, and Turkey Shoot. All very different films, so we might as well get straight to it and talk about the 1982 crime film Dead Easy.
Thank you. Hey.
The famous Jack Keegan, eh? Get home, old man.
So you think? Stand still! Stand still!
Shit, Jack. Couldn't be helped.
What about the mole?
I'll fix it.
The film was directed by Burt Dielig, written by Burt Dielig and Danny Sankey. It stars Scott Burgess, Rosemary Paul, Tim McKenzie, Max Phibbs, Tony Barry, Jack O'Leary, Sandy Gore, and Carlotta. And the plot summary for this one, which I am reading off IMDb, is... Three young friends try to break into the entertainment business, inadvertently anger a mob boss, setting in motion a chain of events that results in them being hunted by every thug and killer in town. Now, Marcy, I know this was a first time watch for you. So tell us your thoughts on Dead Easy.
I will start with this. The plot synopsis that Bede just read, that might be like, the final third of the film.
Yes.
Because that is what happens. It takes two thirds to get there. But talk about a mixed bag, though. The first half felt like it was trying to be gritty, documentary style film that's kind of unintentionally difficult to follow. And then the second half flows a lot better with a big mishmash of genres. It has more fun, and at one point it becomes like The Cars That Ate Paris and Mad Max with a wacky car chase sequence. But it's an intriguing mess of a film, which does sort of act like a time capsule for Sydney in the early 80s, and I will probably use that term again as we talk about these films. I thought that Rosemary Paul was the standout of the cast. The film is just more interesting when she's on screen. Scott Burgess, I found, played it overly obnoxious and not at all likable, which, you know, made it difficult to really follow the film when he was the main focus. It is a weird but oddly interesting film that I actually didn't mind all that much. I definitely understood what they were going for. And while I don't think it works as well as it could have, it's still an interesting and intriguing, weird mishmash of a film.
And Pete, what are your thoughts on Dead Easy?
Well, I would just take what Marcy said and turn it on its head. For me, I just found this a really difficult film to watch, not in a bad way, just in the fact that it was, I don't know, I just didn't find it at all interesting. Now Marcy's got me thinking again about it. But I really didn't know what to make of it. Like, is it a crime thriller sort of movie? Is it an action film? There's some, like, really laughable kind of cliched crime bosses in this movie, like the older guys are very cliched, you know, with the wavy hair and all this sort of stuff, which is very 80s, right? But then we get some boobs and we get an obligatory car chase scene at the end, which makes it, you know, pretty much an exploitation film. And I found it really challenging to watch and to keep my interest. I was, to be honest, was one of those movies where, you know, you look at your watch and you're like, oh, this must be over soon, right? So I'm probably bagging it more than it's probably worth it, but than I need to. But I don't know. It was a strange film for me to watch. I guess, I don't know. Opinions like assholes. Everyone's got one, right? It just didn't click for me.
Yeah. I just wanted to cut in quickly and say I do understand, because I think the first 15 to 20 minutes are, I think, the most challenging to get into because you have no idea what's going on.
Yeah, yeah. And I'll be fair, all the rest of the films we're going to talk about I'm much more positive on. So this one was like, Yeah, it was really difficult to watch.
Yeah, well, this is my first time watching the film as well. And I kind of have to agree with both of you. I think for the first 40 odd minutes, I was very confused about what was going on, because watching the film, there is a lot of plot happening in terms with our main characters and their own individual subplots. And then while it does eventually come together in the last third, which essentially, like you say, Marcy, the plot summary that's on IMDb and also on the back of the DVD, which I did have, pretty much just sums up the last 30 minutes of the film. And it's just essentially just a lot of buildup for the first 40, 50 minutes and essentially giving us the lives of these different characters. But at the same time, though, so much is going on that it is very hard to follow at first. And you can't help but find it really convoluted in terms of its plot, because it's trying to cover so much ground. But that being said, though, I do think that the cast are still pretty solid in their roles. I can definitely see what you mean about Scott Burgess's performance, but for most part, I thought he was pretty solid. But I do think that Rosemary Paul, who plays Alex, I thought she was really good in this film. And I was particularly taken with her character's journey. And also, I think it's a really interesting kind of look at what King's Cross was like in Sydney in the early 80s. I feel like it kind of really captured what that place was like at that time. And also visually, the movie looks really good, because the film's got like two cinematographers on it, Tom Coward and Mike Malloy. And I think visually, even though the copy that was released on DVD by Umbrella, and I'm also assuming the same copy that you both watched as well, is kind of like, a very banged up looking print. But that being said, though, it visually still looked really good. It had a really good, nice atmosphere and style to it.
Yeah, I think the visual of it, and because it's like a very early DVD release, so the quality doesn't look great, it kind of adds to this grungy feel of the movie.
Yeah.
Which you kind of appreciate, because that's what you kind of think of at King's Cross in the early 80s.
Oh, definitely, definitely. And I think it's also interesting too, because I think the co-writer and director of it, Burt Dealing, this was his follow-up film to a film he made in 1975 called Pure Shit, which was a film about heroin addicts. And I haven't seen that film, but I've always heard of it. And from what I understand, that movie is such a gritty, grimy look at heroin addicts. So I guess while this one definitely, from the sounds of it, compared to that one, this one's a bit more mainstream and more accessible, but it does have that grungy quality to it. But also what I really liked about this film is, again, it shows what King's Cross was like at this period in time, but also we get a very big prominent role from legendary trans entertainer Carl Otto, who has a big role in this film as well.
I definitely get what you say about the atmosphere. It's really well shot, I'll say that. And it definitely does. And the whole cross thing is, yeah, absolutely 100%. It's very much King's Cross in the 80s.
Which is why it's great. Like, whether you like the film or not, I think it's great to kind of have films that do act like time capsules, that you get this look into the past.
Yeah, I'm going to talk about that in one of the other movies we're talking about today.
Oh, definitely, definitely. And I guess, when it gets to the last half of the film, it does take this kind of sudden turn into a completely different film, with having this massive car chase scene and with our main characters. And also one of the main characters is a police officer who is meant to be one of the friends of both Scott Burgess and Rosemary Paul's characters, but at first, he seems like more at odds with Scott Burgess's character for at least the first two thirds, until it's like, oh yeah, they're just friends now all of a sudden. Yeah,
Switch, don't they? They sort of, because he's like a good cop that gets hounded out of the police force? These first couple of movies you're talking about today, there's a little bit of a theme of corruption running through a few of these movies, and definitely the case in this one as well.
Oh yeah, definitely, definitely. And that I never even thought about that, Pete, but you're actually right with the films that are on this episode. But also I will admit, what's interesting about this, some of the films we're talking about for this episode, is they basically become different movies in their last third, and we'll talk about that with other films later on. But yeah, like, and also I had to mention that the car they drive in looks like something that's either out of Mad Max or the Cars That Hate Paris.
Hence my references, because the last part certainly has influences from those two. And it did seem like one of the cars was straight out of the Cars That Hate Paris. It was all done up and ready for battle.
Well, I was getting Dead End Drive-In vibes as well.
Ooh.
As well.
Yeah. I actually haven't seen that. Ones I haven't seen before, I am waiting till we get to them on the show to watch them.
Ooh. Did you order The Umbrella?
I haven't pre-ordered the upcoming 4K release of Dead End Drive-In yet, but that's definitely on the docket for sure, because I'm very excited to watch to see how they restore that, even though I haven't seen the movie myself either.
All right, I went all in and got it all, got the whole package.
Nice.
And yeah, because I've seen it a few times. I love it. It's great.
I have a feeling I'll get something out of that, so it definitely is tempting.
Indeed, indeed. But in terms of trivia on this film, one of the first bits of trivia I have is that, and you'll be happy about this, Marcy, director Bert Dealing wrote 13 episodes of the classic Australian soap opera Neighbours from 1999 to 2003.
That's so odd, going from like pure shit and then dead easy to let's just write some Neighbours episodes.
Yeah, it's very weird, like how some filmmakers have that kind of directory in Australia. And Bert Dealing's not the first person to kind of have that, like starting off making specific type of exploitation films and then later on start working on Aussie soaps. Because that happened to even Everett DeRoach, who we've covered a lot on this show as well. And even after his sort of big work in the 80s, during the 90s, he started working on soap operas and TV dramas.
Well, yeah, we just did last episode on my show, we did Snapshot, and a heap of the people that worked on that show came out of Crawford's as well. So it was, it's very interesting how it's all very, I guess it's just a gig, right? It's money.
I mean, you can't complain too much if you're working on a classic soap opera by it. Like Neighbours, and I know Marcy is happy about that, but
I wish I had a writing gig on Neighbours. Those characters wouldn't know what hit them, baby.
we kind of technically do, Marcy. It's called the To Be Tuesdays podcast.
If you want to see what her on-the-fly soap opera is like with characters, watch that podcast.
I always thought Body Melt was like an Ozploitation version of Neighbours.
Oh, it is too, now that you say that, Pete. And I'm looking forward to Marcy's first exposure to that movie later on in the series.
That should be awesome.
But also, final bit of trivia, Scott Burgess starred as Senior Sergeant Dave McCall in the Australian series Water Rats from 1996 to 2000. And it's funny you put that there, Marcy, because I was watching him in this film and I'm thinking, where have I seen him before?
Yep.
And I'm like, oh, yeah, I've seen him back in the late 90s on the odd episode of Water Rats. It's like, oh, yeah, I recognize who he is now.
Yeah, it was the same for me, because I saw, Water Rats was just on at a good time to have on the TV. So it was just on rotation, like on the TV. So I was like, why does this guy look familiar? And then I found that. I was like, oh, makes sense.
Definitely, definitely. But I guess that could be a wrap on this discussion on Dead Easy. Marcy, your final thoughts and rating on this film?
It is an intriguing oddity of a film, and my rating is 2.5 car chases out of nowhere out of 5. I do think it's worth checking out, because it kind of is this weird slice of like Sydney history, and just, I appreciate someone's ambition to try and make a film, and I don't quite know what they were ultimately going for, but it certainly is intriguing.
Definitely, definitely. And Pete, your final thoughts and rating out of 5 on Dead Easy.
Well, you guys have kind of made me rethink, although not in a way that I think I'll ever love the movie, but I'm thinking like, maybe I need to go back and have another look at this film. But Until I do, my rating is like 1/8 of a soft touch camera club out of 5.
I don't blame you for that, Pete, because I have a feeling, because again, like the copy I watched didn't have subtitles or anything on it at all. But I think if Umbrella does decide to restore this film and give it proper subtitles, I feel like it probably will be a much better watch then. But I guess we'll just have to wait and see.
Yeah, it's unfortunate that some of the audio quality on some of these films, even if they did get a DVD release, just isn't the best, and there's no closed captioning. And I will take this opportunity to say I adore your streaming service, Broly. Please add closed captions. I'm begging you. Please.
They don't have closed captions on anything.
Feels like there is none.
Interesting.
Okay. Anyway, continue, Bede.
But for my final thoughts and rating on this film, I give this about 2.5. Carl Lotter is an absolute legend out of 5. like, I think I did, for most part, enjoy it pretty well. But that being said, though, it is a mixed bag at the end of the day, because even though, yes, it has some pretty solid performances, it has a great atmosphere to it. It's visually striking, and so much is going on in this film that I did find intriguing. But I feel like if it was less convoluted, I feel like I probably would have vibed with it a lot more as a film. But since, yeah, it took me a while to kind of get into it because of that, it didn't find it as engaging as it could have been, at least until it got to the third act. Yeah, so overall, 2.5 out of 5 from me. So now we'll move right along to our next film, which of course is the 1981 TV movie, The Killing of Angel Street.
Hi.
Hey, what's wrong?
It was only a couple of ounces.
Well, how'd the police know? Well, they knew because we bought it off them.
Jessica dared to fight for her street. Now she's fighting for her life.
I used to believe that the police, the government, the legal system were there to protect me. It's funny when you find out those are the very people you've got to be protected from.
Why am I being held?
Drunkenness. Soliciting an assault.
Jeez! I was arrested and stripped, my body searched. Have you any idea what that means to me?
You can have a corrupt system made of thousands of incorruptible people. Big business, out to make a buck and not too fussy, organized crime, looking for a laundry for some dirty money, and the government who has to protect the property owner.
Keep the union out of my business.
What do you want me to say?
That your father died in an accident. That you withdraw all allegations of intimidation. There's a lot of nonsense talked about Angel Street, and you disassociate yourself from it completely.
If they were going to kill someone you love because of what I might say, would you still ask me to say it?
Their power is frightening, and the prize is multi-million dollar profit. One woman stands in their way. No!
Which was directed by Donald Crombie, written by Cecil Holmes, Evan Jones, and Michael Craig, from a story by Michael Craig. And this film stars Elizabeth Alexander, John Hargreaves, Reg Lyle, David Downer, Kaz Lederman, Alexander Archdale, Alan Bickford, and Gordon McDougall. And the plot summary from IMDb is, Jessica Simmons returns from overseas to find her retired professor father in a bitter public fight to save the historic Sydney waterfront houses of Angel Street. After her father's mysterious death, she joins forces with local residents and a union leader against corrupt forces. This film is based on the real-life mysterious disappearance of Juanita Nielsen. Before we go into our thoughts on this movie. I want to make a clarification about this film. Now, when I was putting the episode list for this show together, I mistakenly put The Killing of Angel Street as a 1982 release, when in fact it was actually 1981. And I'm blaming Wikipedia for this, but then again, I've also should have done a bit more research into this. So yeah, this film was technically a 1981 release. So if I knew that, we would have covered this film on an earlier episode. But that being said, though, Marcy, your thoughts on The Killing of Angel Street?
Oh, the corruption. Oh, yeah. I had no idea what to expect with this one. I don't know much about the true story it was based on. It is a hard-hitting film at times with some very intense and even horrific scenes. What I think bogs it down a little is the pacing, and I think that would have benefited from being a little bit tighter in places, and, you know, it sort of can change tones a little unexpectedly. But overall, it's a very compelling film, even if as a TV movie it has the TV movie feel. But, you know, even today, dare I say, it's topical but controversial, and the topic that it tackles, I'm sure, ruffled a few feathers with people. And I think it's anchored quite well by the two lead performances, by John Hargreaves as Elliot and Elizabeth Alexander as Jess, who share chemistry and also have, you know, great screen charisma. And I think this is certainly worth tracking down and watching. And I haven't actually seen, I guess, the companion film. I think it was called Heat Wave with...
Yes.
Oh, my God, I'm going blank on who stars in it now.
Judy Davis.
Judy Davis, yes. With director Philip Noyce. It covers the same, true story. I haven't seen that, and that was more of a new wave film, but I am kind of intrigued to see it and see how, you know, different filmmakers and everybody like tackled the same kind of subject. But this was a massive surprise. I liked this movie.
And Pete, your thoughts on The Killing of Angel Street?
So this movie is like a really unique time capsule for what was happening in Sydney during the late 70s and 80s. So it's loosely based on the green bans against building development that was carried out and supported by the Builders Labourers Federation in Sydney. The Builders Labourers at the time would basically just refuse to carry out work on sites that they deemed either environmentally or socially undesirable. And the green bans were credited essentially was saving like the Rocks area of Sydney, which was all basically wanting to be developed amongst a whole lot of other areas of Sydney. So the film seems to be dovetailing into the beginning of that movement, where you've got John Hargreaves being the union guy and them starting those whole green bans. So it's also interesting that you mentioned as well the real-life disappearance of Juanita Nielsen. So she was an activist against mass development in the late 70s, and she went missing in July 75, and her body's never been found. So now we sound like a crime podcast. There's some thought that she was a victim of organized crime, police corruption, which is once again is a theme running through this movie. Yeah, and now that history lesson's done, I really enjoyed the film. I thought the cast was pretty good. The characters and the villains mostly are a bit overdrawn, some of them. I liked Alexander Archdale, who plays B.C. Simmons, or Simo as they keep calling him. He's only in the movie probably, what, the first third? He's the father of Jessica and the film's protagonist, or she is. The only thing that was a bit of a letdown for me is I felt like Marcy was saying that it could have done with a bit of cutting, and I agree in some places the pacing could be a bit better. But I kind of think the ending was a little bit rushed and abrupt. And I think the film would have benefited from just a little bit of an epilogue of some sort. And but other than that, I thought it was good. Yeah, enjoyed it.
Well, I got to say, this movie was an absolute surprise for me as well. And it's one that I had heard about for quite a while, especially when organizing this podcast. So I was already very much aware of it. And sitting down to watch it, Like, I was really taken in by the story. Like, I didn't know that it was partially based on a true story until, you know, once I watched it and did my research on it. So it was kind of interesting to see that. And watching it, I could definitely see why this type of story would have been quite a topical and a controversial issue at the time. I mean, so much so that the Juanita Nielsen disappearance became the topic of both a TV movie and a theatrically released film. So it's definitely a story that was on the mind of a lot of people at that time. So even though, yes, this film is only partially based on that and actually had to create new characters and change a lot of things around it, but it's still a pretty compelling film. Like, I wasn't sure what to expect from this film, and it had me from the beginning. And then once, and I agree with you, Pete, that Alexander Archdale is great as B.C. Simmons. And you can definitely see the rapport between him and his daughter, Jessica, who's also played greatly by Liz Alexander. And then when he dies and the story kind of escalates, I just found it very enthralling. And I guess I can see some people's issues about the police, the building site managers and the corruption and all that can be seen as a little over the top, but I feel like it's very warranted here. And where it goes in the third act, I actually found quite intense, especially when, and since this is a spoiler podcast, I have to reveal this, when John Hargreaves' character is unceremoniously killed off on screen, which I did not see coming. And then Jessica gets kidnapped, and she gets threatened being thrown over a skyscraper. And
I said, horrific scenes in this movie. And
I literally said this, to quote our other podcast, Marcy the Toopy Tuesdays podcast, that escalated quickly. but yeah, I found that such an intense last half. And you also could see the kind of the stress and the paranoia and the fear that Jessica is feeling. Like, she wants to reveal what these corrupt police officers and businessmen are doing, but at the same time, her life is at stake and also the people that she's also helping as well. So you kind of see the conundrum that she's feeling. And I can also see your point about the ending being rather abrupt, Pete, and I can definitely see that. But it kind of worked for me as being, it's one of those endings where the abruptness actually worked, at least for me, because it's simultaneously both like, yeah, they kind of won, but at the same time, our main character's also lost as well. So it's an interesting way to end the film. And I did find that when it went over the credits and you can hear the voices of characters chatting and stuff like that, I just found it quite haunting. But that being said, though, also John Hargreaves, who we've talked a lot on this show, he's great in this TV movie. I guess my only big issue with this movie is I did feel that Brian May scored, no, not that Brian May, which I have to say in every episode, I did feel like his score was a little too melodramatic and actually made the film feel like a TV movie even more so. So I feel like if his score was actually downplayed a little bit, it probably would have been more effective. But outside of that, I just found it a really compelling film.
Yeah, I thought so too. I think they actually make you care for the characters quite a bit. Like, I caught myself when John Hargreaves is murdered at the end of the film. I'm like, oh, he's not dead, is he? Surely he's not dead, right? And then I'm like, fuck, he's dead. When they were hanging Jessica off the edge of the building by the legs, I was like, fair dinkum, are they going to actually drop her? Is this the ending of the movie, or is this something weird that's going to happen where suddenly our two main protagonists are out of the movie? I was like, oh, that's interesting. But the only thing is, I would have liked to have seen what she'd said in that interview at the end of the TV interview. I'm thinking she probably maybe said something, because we do get that little wrap up at the end where the developers sort of saying there was a little bit of damage done to our reputation, et cetera, and whatever. But yeah, I don't know. It would have been good to have a little bit more of a wrap up on that. But I understand your point too, that it was an interesting way to end.
Yeah, agreed. I think it's a really well put together movie for the most part, and it's very compelling. It deals with a lot of stuff that, you know, was going on at the time, and probably certain things haven't failed to stop. And yeah, I agree that the end was a little rushed, but I kind of get the point of what they were going for.
Mm-hmm. That's true. Mm-hmm. And the whole Juanita Nielsen thing, I was reading that apparently they went back and forth with lawyers all the time when they were writing the script, when they were making the film, saying, oh, can we do this? Can we do this? Can we make this reference? And so, yeah, they had to be very careful what they were doing there as well.
Yeah, and it's funny you mentioned that too, Pete, because one of the bits of trivia we have written down here is that, of course, you know, the lawyers, due to the intense controversy surrounding the disappearance of Juanita Nielsen, every draft of the script had to be looked at by them and for legal reasons. And also to make even more how insane this production was, is that they couldn't actually film on any real streets. So they had to build a street for this film so they couldn't get into legal trouble, which kind of blows my mind.
It's mind-blowing, isn't it?
That's what I mean. It's like whatever was going on with this story at the time must have been really that hot button of a topic, like an intense one for sure.
For sure. Because I think, was it set in Balmain? It looked more like Piemont to me, but it looks like maybe it was set in Balmain. I don't know.
Well, I think based on the trivia I've got here, it does say that instead a whole terrace house street was constructed for filming in Sydney Harbour side suburb of Balmain. But okay. In terms of other trivia for this film, this picture was one of 50 Australian films selected for preservation as part of the National Film and Sound Archive of Australia's Kodak Atlab Cinema Collection Restoration Project. So I will say, like, even the version, the copy of the film I watched, it actually looked really good. So you can definitely tell that they definitely worked on restoring this one. And I won't be surprised later on, because Umbrella has released this film on DVD. So I won't be surprised if maybe later on down the track, they'll do another restoration of it and even give it a Blu-ray release.
I think they listen to the podcast, because things that we cover seem to be released like months later. And it's like, okay, I could have watched it on a nice copy if you released it earlier, but if I'm inspiring someone to release movies, sure, let's go.
I always get really sad when you have to look movies up on, like, you know, B gave me the list of where to see these movies. And it's like, well, this one you can get on Prime. This one's on the Internet Archive. And this one you've got to go to YouTube for. It's quite sad, you know, that you can't. A lot of these films, they're either out of print or they're not on any streaming service. And it's back to my argument about physical media.
Exactly.
Exactly. And also, Marcy, in between this episode and the last one, two movies we covered on the last episode, they're currently being restored and going to be released on Blu-ray. So kind of just shows how quickly Umbrella are listening to this podcast, I'm assuming. Possibly, maybe. I'm not sure. But another bit of trivia. Julie Christie. Yes, Academy Award-winning actress Julie Christie was originally considered for the role of Jessica Simmons and agreed to take part. But due to script delays and funding problems, she later opted out. And knowing about Julie Christie, I could definitely see why this film would appeal to her, because knowing sort of her background in terms of politics and social causes, this type of story would have been very intriguing to her to do.
Pretty meaty role too, right? Had a lot to do, a lot of acting in there.
Oh, definitely. But I think Elizabeth Alexander still did a great job in the role, and she was very, very good in it. But also another little bit of trivia I just added, Marcy, one of the co-writers of this film, Evan Jones, he's someone we have talked about before on the show, all the way back on our very first episode, because he was the writer of Wake and Fright.
Oh, there you go.
So that explains why this movie was very intense in parts.
I thought you were going to make another Neighbours connection.
Well, I was looking up the Donald Crombie's filmography to see if he has any connections to Neighbours, but from the looks of it, I don't think he does. Although, after this film, he would actually go on to direct the time-traveling Aussie drama playing Petey Bow. And also a couple other movies and TV shows as well. So, yeah, but I guess that could be a wrap on... Oh, wait a minute. Now I'm looking. He's directed episodes of McLeod's Daughters. That also...
Oh, well, there, that fits.
But I guess that could be a wrap on this conversation of The Killing of Angel Street. Ah, Marcy, your final thoughts and rating for this film?
I give this 3.5 corrupt dudes out of 5. It's well worth checking out. It's well worth watching. I think it's just a really compelling and interesting film that certainly anchored by some good performances and, you know, kind of combining truth with fiction in certain ways. But again, it's like a time capsule into sort of the 70s and 80s with that part of Australia and what was going on.
And Pete, your final thoughts and rating on the film?
Yeah, this is was a surprise, actually. I didn't know what to expect. I heard about this movie a lot over the years, but never watched it. And I found it really entertaining. I found it really interesting. I found it a bit nerve-wracking, as we were saying before. Really well put together, really enjoyed it. And I give it 4 corrupt cops out of 5.
You know, I agree with you, Pete. I'm also giving this 4 out of 5 as well. This one was a massive surprise. I did not expect to like it as much as I did. I thought, you know, the plot was intriguing, but I didn't expect it to find it as compelling as I thought it was going to be. Like, I think the performances are all very strong. The story is still very topical and compelling. And I just was riveted by it from beginning to end, particularly when it got to its third act, which I just found incredibly intense. So yeah, this one was a massive surprise for me and definitely worth checking out if anyone is interested in watching it. Now we'll move right along to our third film, which of course is the comedic noir, or should I say, yeah, noir, as they call it here in Australia, Goodbye Paradise.
Isabel came down to play. And now as I wander, my thoughts ever stray.
Save your brain cells, Stacy. Plenty more hangovers where this one came from.
Mexico way.
I've seen you before, Stacy. You put on a suicidal front, but at bottom you're still an Irish Catholic and you don't believe in it.
Well, I'm just getting into training for purgatory. That's all. It could be a valuable experience for this growing lad. Throw me another one. Some hundreds of years before tonight, by a coincidence that didn't surprise either her or me, I'd been almost engaged to Kate back when the world was young. Here she was again, lads, 2 whole marriages later, hers and mine, moving slowly closer to the center of my life. I knew she was there, but I drew back from going to her and putting my head in her bosom and crying like a baby. We old soldiers have some pride. The Irish mistress wasn't helping my appreciation of the music or the decor. The crooner sounded like 2 old cheese graters fornicating in an iron tank. And the wallpaper was beginning to look hostile.
Down in Mexico way.
Hi, Stacy.
As she sighed, as she whispered, mañana.
Never dreaming
that we were parting. As I lied and I whispered, mañana. For tomorrow never came.
Liz!
South of the border.
Hey, how are you?
Oh, I'm all right.
Christ, you look rotten, Mike. Bloody awful.
You should see me on my bad days.
Yeah, we can leave this for some other time, eh? Our mate is union business trades, all you know how it is.
Yeah, sure.
I'm in the book.
That's Ted Godfrey. He's not trades hall anymore, is he?
Well, that's one rule.
Which was directed by Carl Schultz, written by Bob Ellis and Denny Lawrence, based on an original idea by Denny Lawrence. This film stars Ray Barrett, Robin Nevin, Guy Dolman, Lex Marinos, Paul Chubb, Tex Morton, and Kate Fitzpatrick. And the plot summary, from which I'm reading off IMDb, is: on Queensland's Gold Coast in the early 1980s, when a disgraced former cop, Michael Stacy, writes a book exposing police corruption, does an investigation in resulting in 2 murders, exposes a religious cult, and watches the army begin a military coup. Now, Marcy, your thoughts on Goodbye Paradise?
Yep, talk about a surprise. Goodbye Paradise certainly delivered a surprise. This is an Ozploitation neo-noir with, again, corruption at the center, and damn, they actually kind of pulled it off. Ray Barrett gives a fantastic performance as the down on his luck Stacy. He's managing to get himself into all sorts of situations, as you heard in the plot synopsis. I love how he had just presence in every scene. He had this like weird essence of charisma about him, but he just also came off like your unlucky uncle that you see like once or twice a year. I do think, like, as great as the film is, it sort of takes maybe a little too long to get there. And again, I think maybe you could have lost 20 minutes and had a tighter film without losing any of this flair, because it has a lot of flair. But at almost 2 hours, I think it's a little long. But what is there is great. This is definitely one, again, like, people need to find this. This is such a unique film that, dare I say, it has its charms, even if there's a weird religious sex cult and an army military group.
Definitely. And Pete, your thoughts on Goodbye Paradise?
I'm exactly with Marcy on this one. This was a great surprise, this movie. Knew nothing about this movie when I came into it and found myself absolutely engrossed in the story. I love the use of narration to move the story along and provide information and context. Like you, Marcy, I think Ray Barrett was perfectly cast, like as the washed up, disgraced and alcoholic ex-cop who finds some purpose in his life and I reckon a bit of redemption in the end. All the other performances were great too. I really cared for the characters, and that's something that's, you know, been something in the last couple of movies we just talked about where I actually cared for the characters. The conspiracy theory fuel plot was interesting to say the least, but I wasn't 100% sure how at the end of the day they were going to just annex just the Gold Coast to complete their plan and get away with it. And of course they didn't. And of course, it was really nice to see Grant Dodwell from A Country Practice cast as SeaWorld Boy in this film. That's what his name is. And I think he's also the guy that assassinates the counselor or something in that scene. Is it? I don't know. In that scene there's some community get together or something anyway. But so on a personal note, I get pangs of nostalgia with this film every time I see him hanging out at Charlie's on Cavill Avenue. So that's that cafe they go to. I don't know if you noticed it in the movie. Around the time this was shot and this movie was set, I was living in Surfers Paradise and I was working as a full-time muse. I was doing 6 nights a week at this resort called Ocean Blue Resort. And we'd often finish the show about 11 o'clock at night every night. And then we'd go to the nightclub and we'd spend a couple of hours in the nightclub until they kicked us out. And then we'd go down to Cavill Avenue, and Charlie's was a 24/7 cafe. So we'd sit there and we'd have coffee, depending on what condition we were in. We'd have coffee, we'd have a bite to eat, and then we'd go and sit on the beach and watch the sun come up. And that was basically our day. And seeing this cafe in this show was like, yeah, it was great for me. And I even looked into it, and it looks like it's actually now closed. It was like an institution in Surfers for like 40 years or something. Yeah, but the movie is fantastic. I really enjoyed it. It's a really good watch.
Yeah, I have to say, I really enjoyed this one as well. Like, I kind of went into it because I knew that it was a neo-noir film, or what I was mentioning before. The Australian equivalent of a spaghetti western is a meat pie western. Then the Australian equivalent of a neo-noir is a yeah noir, which yeah, I have noir, been hearing. Mate. Yeah, noir, mate. Which I have been hearing a lot lately. So I knew that, but I didn't expect this film to be as funny as it is. And I think it really comes down to the writing from Bob Ellis and Denny Lawrence. Like, yeah, like Dead Easy, it took me a little bit to get into the plot at times because, like a lot of neo-noir films, like the plot is so intricate and intertwined with so much going on that it can be a little hard to follow at times, especially when our main character is kind of investigating this disappearance. And then eventually everything sort of comes together in the end. So that kind of aspect I did find a little muddled, but outside of that, but I think what made it work though was, again, like I said, the sense of humor that the film had, and also Ray Barrett's fantastic performance as Stacy. I thought he was absolutely sold every scene he was in. And like you say, Marcy, like he is the equivalent of that kind of uncle character. when you watch the film, but he knows exactly what he's doing and you can't help but be on his side. And also he comes out with some great lines throughout the film that are both hilarious and also make him charming as a character. Particularly his relationship with his landlady, which I did find quite hilarious.
It was something. Say that.
He was basically like, "Oh, why don't you stop complaining and just have an affair with me already?" Or something along the lines of that. And she's like, you can see it, it's like she's contemplating it.
The room was too untidy.
Exactly. And also how this film, like Surfer's Paradise in this film, is essentially another character in it. This movie, I will not be surprised if it does get a Blu-ray release at some point, because visually it looked fantastic. And the copy that I watched, which was on Prime Video, looked great. And the cinematography from John Seale, who we've talked about a lot on this show, even in the last episode, because he also shot The Survivor and would go on to win an Oscar later on down the track. It's just so beautiful. It really captures the sort of the sunny vibe of Surfer's Paradise. But the way that it's shot, it feels like it's shot a lot of the film either at sunrise or sunset, because it just looks so beautiful to look at. And another thing about this film, I got to give it credit for, it goes into directions you will not expect. Like you say, there's a religious sex cult that's in this movie.
Just randomly in there as part of the plot. Which and you don't then, think it is at first.
Yeah.
Because it just kind of pops up because he's looking for the daughter of the politician guy. Can't even remember at this point who it was. But then it comes back later because there's other people involved and there's all this other stuff going on. It's insane.
I thought when I read about this movie, I read something, I'm not sure if you got it in your notes, Pete. I read something about originally the movie was going to be more about him looking for that daughter, the daughter in a cult, and the cult was very much like one of those Heaven's Gates cults and that sort of thing. And then they changed it around and made this military coup storyline thing.
Oh, definitely. And I got to talk about the third act of this movie. Like at this point, like in the first two halves, like, okay, this is a crazy little movie. It's got a lot of humor. Like it does have some serious moments in there, but it never forgets to provide a lot of jokes throughout. But then all of a sudden, it takes a turn in the third act and literally becomes a completely different movie. I'm just going to say it. It felt like one of the films we're going to be talking about later, Turkey Shoot.
Yes.
It felt like the ending of Turkey Shoot.
A little bit.
So there's the bit where his friend, I can't remember, one of the friends he was in the army with or something, standing near a waterfall with the machine gun shooting at people, and his body was almost in exactly the same position as the Thatcher character at the end of Turkey Shoot before he gets his head and shoulders blown off. Like, oh, wow, I'm getting Turkey Shoot vibes.
Yeah, and it's weird, and this ending just comes out of nowhere because, like, he's been kidnapped and is, like, tied up and tortured. He passes out, and then when he wakes up, there's gunfire and everything going on, and people are screaming all around, and all the characters that we have seen before are dropping dead. Like, I'm like, am I watching Rambo? What is this?
And one of the characters, which looked like a crim, must have been an ex-cop or something that knew him, that almost looked like he was threatening his life through the movie, ended up being like an undercover guy for the army or something like that, that was helped put down the coup. I was like, what?
It
kind of goes full commando or something like at the end. It's like, you've watched this movie. It's like a funny but, you know, intriguing, interesting film and all this. And then suddenly, it becomes like fucking commando. And it's like, I don't know what's going on, but I kind of like it.
Yeah,
like if you're going to do an Aussie neo-noir, mate, do it in style. And they certainly did.
Oh, definitely.
I was just going to say, you get all that. And then you get this beautiful final scene in the film. Like you were talking about the cinematography before, where he's just walking on the beach with his dog and it looks like dawn or dusk or something like that. And it just looks so gorgeous, the last shot of the film. It's amazing.
Oh, yeah. Oh, it is. Like, it's a beautifully shot film. But it's just that ending. I think my Letterboxd review was like, the only thing I wrote about it was like, well, I didn't see that third act coming.
Nobody did.
But that's what makes, that's probably why this film, like, there's a lot of aspects about it that definitely make it an exploitation film, because there's a lot of gratuitous nudity and just some weird aspects to it. But yeah, this movie is just nuts. And it's kind of funny to me looking at Bob Ellis's work, like some of the other projects he's worked on. He's written a few films for Paul Cox, one of Australia's most astute indie auteurs. So I'm thinking, how could somebody who writes films for a filmmaker as serious as Paul Cox could write something as nutty like this?
Stranger things have happened.
Indeed. Although that also explains, because Carl Schultz would go on to direct the Demi Moore film, The Seventh Sign, later on. So this movie kind of explains a lot of things.
Kind of, yeah. But there's like so much weird stuff going on. But I'll give the movie credit, because I was a little worried it was going to get into uncomfortable territory. Because the girl, the daughter character that he has to find is like 17, and he's the godfather. And she makes references to them sleeping together, but he resists it. And I'm just glad they didn't go there, because I think that would have just really turned me off that character. And the fact that they, you know, maybe had it like she's having a little bit of a crush on this dude and kind of leave it at that with nothing sexual going on between the characters, I was just glad that they kind of kept it very above board, because I really didn't want to have to hate the character for something like that.
Yeah, I was the same as you, and I kind of in the end I thought, oh, maybe it's to give it the benefit of the doubt and give her the benefit of the doubt. Maybe it's like misplaced affection sort of thing.
Definitely. In terms of trivia for this film, like The Killing of Angel Street, this film was one of 50 Australian films selected for preservation as part of the National Film and Sound Archive, so that's pretty cool. And understandably so, like Killing of Angel Street, you could definitely tell they did do some kind of restoration on this film as well. So you could definitely tell that when you watch it. The film was nominated for a whole bunch of AFI awards, or like the Australian Academy Awards, essentially, and now known as the ACTRA Awards. And it won two for Best Original or Adapted Screenplay for Bob Ellis and Denny Lawrence. And deservedly, Ray Barrett won Best Actor for his performance in this film. And finally, and this was what made me sad when I read this trivia, a sequel called Goodbye Adelaide by the film's screenwriters Bob Ellis and Denny Lawrence was written but never made. The story would feature Michael Stacey completing his expose and launching the book at the Adelaide Festival, where he gets involved in an attempted defection by a Russian agent. So it's very clear, just based on that plot summary, like it would kind of start off being kind of similar to this film, but then again would go a little insane. So I'm kind of a little sad that a sequel was not made to this film, because I would have loved to have seen more adventures with Michael Stacey.
I mean, yeah, it's kind of sad, especially when you've got like a defection by a Russian agent. And, you know, possibly taking place in Adelaide, where I'm from originally. That would have been pretty cool. But unfortunately, we can't always get what we want.
Indeed. Exactly. But I guess that could be a wrap on this discussion of Goodbye Paradise. And Marcy, your final thoughts and rating for this film?
It's a heck of a film, that's for sure. I give it 3.5 bugged bananas out of 5. Out of all the insane plot points, the fact that he picks up a banana near the beginning with that weird sex cult, he has it on him the whole film, didn't realize it was bugged, and that's how everything happened. So very clever, such a wacky plot device, and I fucking loved it with that. So I think my rating is very fair. It's definitely check it out.
Oh, I completely forgot about the bugged banana. And that was like, it's like, oh, he's still got that banana in his pocket. And then you find out, oh, it was bugged the entire time. Like, what? Now, Marcy, I'm going to ask you this. Do you think this movie would even be better if Barry McKenzie was the lead character?
I think the way it is great.
Barry McKenzie should have been in the sequel. But Pete, your final thoughts and rating for Goodbye Paradise?
People should seek this movie out. It's really good. It's really worth watching. It's enjoyable. It's got, like you said, the big change up in the last third. It's well acted. There's some sad bits. I felt really sorry for his, was his girlfriend or his...
Yeah.
As she accidentally starts his car when the bomb was meant for him, all that sort of stuff. But great movie. I give it 4 alcoholic blackouts out of 5.
I give this one about 3.5 out of 5. Like I said, I think if the story, at least in the first 2/3, was a little less convoluted, I would have been into it just a tad more at first. And I agree with what you were saying before, Marcy. It does have a bit of pacing issues and probably didn't need to be nearly 2 hours long. Like, they could have easily have taken out maybe 10 minutes of it and it would have just tightened the film. But overall, it's still a really entertaining film that's got some insane moments. It's got some great laughs throughout and also just a fantastic performance from Ray Barrett at the center of it. And this is definitely, again, a big surprise for this episode. And I really enjoyed it a lot. Now, moving on to our 4th film, which is a film I have a kind of a connection to, but I'll get to that momentarily. And that, of course, is the film Running on Empty, also known as Fast Lane Fever in the US.
Spoto a 57 shell, a blown 57 two-door.
That's a sweet noise you got there, man. I had you picked clear across the valley.
You got a nice machine yourself. Want a race?
Yeah, you're too much. You cats need any go juice. The place is 10 miles up the track.
This film was directed by John Clark, written by Barry Toblin and John Clark. It stars Terry Shiro, Deborah Conway, Max Cullen, Vangelis Mourouchas, and I probably butchered your last name, so please forgive me, and Richard Moir. And the plot summary from IMDb is, Mike is a young man who is a budding street racer and owner of a Ford Falcon GTHO Phase 3. His best mate and mechanic, Tony, are both steelworkers by day, but when they aren't working, they are racing. Now, Marcy, your thoughts on Running on Empty and not the River Phoenix film from a few years after this one?
Well, funny story. I saw this way back when I was maybe 12 or something. I wanted to rent the Sydney Lumet Running on Empty, sorry, River Phoenix. But they put this one away for me instead. So I just took it home, watched it, figured, I'll get the other one in a few days when it was back at the video store. And at that time, I had seen American Graffiti recently, and I thought this was like the Aussie version of that in a way. After a rewatch, yeah, it kind of is. But this has a very strong, like, Corman feel, and it definitely shares some commonalities with Corman releases such as Eat My Dust and Grand Theft Auto, with a massive, like, 50s, like, flavor thrown in. It's no surprise that it was actually Corman who did the American distribution for the film. You know, Running on Empty is another film that certainly feels like a time capsule, and this one into that country life of teens, young adults, and the culture there in the early 80s. I think where it lacks in some places, it certainly makes up for in others. Like, the stunts alone are incredible to witness. As far as, like, the cast goes, I felt that Vangelis Mourouchas, apologies if that's not how you pronounce the name, was the standout. He's I feel like Tony's kind of the heart and soul of the film because Mike is a bit of a fuckhead, we'll be fair. Like, he's kind of a typical, I guess, like, character, but he is a bit of a fuckhead, so he needs the balance. And there are a lot of, like, great characters that are introduced. And, of course, the bad guy, I guess, played by Richard Moir, it kind of just pulls it off a little bit too well. It's a pretty, you know, fun and decent film that, yeah, it might sort of drag on a little bit at times, but there's certainly a lot of good and fun moments. And again, the car and stunt work is phenomenal. And this certainly is like a true cult classic for, you know, 80s Australian cinema.
And Pete, your thoughts on Ruddy on Empty?
Well, knock me down with a feather. We've got a good old Ozploitation / Carsploitation movie. I had a lot of fun with this. The plot's very basic street racing kind of movie with a side dish of a road trip to a wise old blind street racer somewhere in the outback who makes the movie more enjoyable than it ought to be, I think. He's probably one of my favorite characters in the movie. And I think my other favorite characters in the movie are those two cops. One looked like
yes.
Looks like a bargain bin Weird Al Yankovic. And the other one, as I think you mentioned to me earlier today, Pete, looks like the tough female cop from Police Academy.
Yes.
But it's a lot of fun. It's brainless fun. The car stunts, as Marcy said, are fantastic. There's a lot going on. Cars are great. It's very much of its time, the 80s. I think this got a bit of a cult following, especially amongst car aficionados and rev heads of all ages and whatnot. So, yeah, great film, really fun film.
Where to start with Running on Empty? I guess I have to sort of state this before my feelings on the film overall. Why I have a personal connection to this film is because this film was shot in my old hometown of Cobar, or at least most of it. All the scenes that you see where our main characters are driving around the country and having races and stuff like that, that is all Cobar. Like, I'm just sitting there watching this film and I'm sitting there like, oh yeah, I remember that road. I know where that road is. And I know, and oh yeah, that's the old res. That's, I know where that is. And even when they have a couple of scenes in town, I'm like, oh, that's the old train station right there. So I pretty much knew about this film growing up because that is one of the proudest things my old hometown has is that this film was shot there. And also, like you say, Pete, it is not only has a cult following, it has a cult following in my old hometown as well. So they fully embrace this film to the point where a couple of years ago, and they do this every few years, they have the Running on Empty Festival where they actually get car enthusiasts from all over the country to bring their cars and also some replicas from the ones in the film to Cobar so they can have a bit of a festival there and also screen the movie as well. So they happen every couple of years. I know they did one for the 35th anniversary of the film, and they did one a few years ago for the 40th anniversary, and even some of the actors and the director John Clark came out to the festival. And there's a couple of videos of it online, and I'm watching some of the videos. I'm like, oh yeah, I know who that person is. And it's like, oh yeah, it's Cobar. And although I will admit though, when it showed like Rebels gas station, I'm thinking, where exactly is that? Because I can't think of it. And then when they showed it in the videos from the festival, I'm like, oh yeah, they tore it down. That explains so much.
It's not there anymore.
And also around the time when this video was made, Cobar had a lot of rain and it was just great. I'm like, oh yeah, I can barely recognize the place. But so when it comes to the movie itself, like you, Marcy, I first heard about this film when I was younger. It's like, oh, this film, Running on Empty, was shot in Cobar. And my first thought was the River Phoenix film. That's because that was the title. I'm thinking, oh, so River Phoenix, Christine Lardy, John Hirsch, and Sydney Lumet, they come to Cobar to make this film. And then I found that it wasn't the Running on Empty I was speaking of. It was a completely different movie. So I watched it in my teens, and I enjoyed it. And rewatching it now, I still enjoyed the film overall, but it definitely is a film that knows exactly what it is. Mm. It definitely is a car film through and through. Like, there's very little plot in this film.
But the plot, let me just put it simple. If you had the game version of Double Dragon, but just with cars, that's literally it. They like threaten the guy's girlfriend. They don't quite kidnap her, but they threaten to do things. And that's essentially, that. It's kind of like that. Like, I kind of want a game that's Double Dragon, but with cars now.
Yes. And also, I forgot Deborah Conway, Australian singer Deborah Conway, was the female lead in this movie. So I completely forgot about that. And also...
Well, actually, both leads are from Australian rock bands.
Yes. Terry Ciro is also the lead singer of a band as well. So it was kind of funny, like, watching this film. But the thing that really struck me the most about this film, other than, yes, the plot is very simple. And I do think at times it does tend to drag with certain things with the story. But one of the things I found so puzzling about this movie, and it never occurred to me even the first time I watched it, it's like, where's this movie set? Because, like, it's clearly mentions that it's set in the 80s, but the aesthetic of it is very 50s. All the teen characters and all the cars feel like they're from a 50s movie. I was just thinking, like, is this set in the 50s? But then later, Rebel, played brilliantly by Max Cullen, the character who, the driver who we find out who's actually blind, and I feel like he also is another character who kind of steals the whole film. He sort of mentions, like, oh, back when I was a young man in the 50s, I'm like, what's this?
It goes again. I feel like the American Graffiti connection is kind of there because that was a film that was set before it, like when it came out, it was set in the past. So I feel like there's a bit of mishmash with this 50s feel, but in like a rural country town, Australia in the 80s. So I kind of like that.
Yeah, well, I think that's what makes the film unique is, you know, it's funny, this movie kind of reminded me a little bit of Streets of Fire, the Walter Hill film, which kind of mixes 80s and 50s aesthetic with its visual look. So that's what the film kind of reminded me of when I was watching it. But yeah, the car stunts are really, really good and really well done. They're dangerous. And I do like the fact that the two cops that are featured throughout all of it are basically are not doing their job very well because these guys get into absolute accidents and explosions and everything. So that was kind of funny. But yeah, overall, I did enjoy the film. Like, it's definitely not a perfect film. It is a pretty solid, enjoyable film where I could definitely get the cult following behind it, not just from car enthusiasts, but also why my hometown of Cobar loves this movie so much.
Isn't that funny? I was, I mentioned this to you earlier, B, via Twitter, and I was watching this movie and I'm thinking to myself when I look at the cast and I'm looking up all this data, I'm like, why is the name Terry Serio familiar to me? I'm like, why do I know that name? And I'm like, oh, he's like a mutual friend of mine on Facebook with a whole lot of other music. I actually sent him a message. He hadn't replied yet. I sent him a message and I was just saying, I did this podcast. They were talking about Running on Empty. I said, you don't really know me, but you know me through Murray Cook from the Wiggles, blah, 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 a few other guys. And I said, this is you, right? Because I looked up the photo of him now on Facebook and I looked up his photo on IMDb, like a fairly recent one. I'm like, it's definitely the same person. And he actually wrote a song for this movie as well. He's credited,
yep,
as, which I can't remember the song. Sorry, Terry. Yeah, interesting.
Oh, it is. Like, that's the thing. Like, what I was sort of like reading up before, like the other day about this film, actually, the film actually did pretty well at the box office when it came out. Like, I would say amazingly, but it actually, compared to other Ozploitation films that we've covered on this show, it actually did pretty solid business at the box office.
This would have been a pretty massive drive-in movie, too, I would
have. Oh, yeah. Yeah, I think that's where, from based on what I've read, where a lot of the money came from was from drive-in theaters.
Yeah, you'd think so because people take their cars there. I also remember when it came out on video, I remember seeing it everywhere in that classic Roadshow clamshell box. And yeah, it was. I remember that poster of him behind the wheel everywhere.
Yeah, I remember that too, Pete, just like in the video shop, because they always proudly put that video somewhere in the video shop at my old hometown. Like a couple of other things have been shot in my town since that film, but like the odd thing here and there. But it really is, that's the film that I think when my old hometown talks about like having big movies coming out to shoot there, that's the one they're the most proudest of. And the fact that they do have a festival every few years kind of says so says
That's
so much as well.
cool. It's really cool living places where films are shot. I used to live in the Sutherland Shire, and we got all excited when they were shooting some of the scenes from Beyond Thunderdome in the sandhills at Wanda Beach and stuff like that. And of course, Puberty Blues was shot at Cronulla and stuff like that. But yeah, it's always interesting.
In terms of trivia of this film was the first feature film production for the Australian Corporation of Western Australia. We of the Never Never and Windsor Jarrah would follow, which I find very interesting because this film was shot in Sydney and shot in Cobar. Although I will say this though, they didn't get it. It takes a long drive to get from Sydney to Cobar. It takes about a 10-hour drive. They did not drive all the way out there just to do race. This is some American thinking, like everything is outside of Sydney type of stuff here. But I think it's interesting that it was actually the Western Australia actually were the production corporation behind this film.
It is interesting.
It's weird. It's like it's such a very weird piece of trivia that it's the first feature film for the Film Corporation of Western Australia, but even though it's a Western Australian like film corporation production, they filmed it in New South Wales.
And the cars used in this movie include a 57 Chevy Coupe, a Ford Falcon GTHO Phase 3 XY, a HG Monaro, and a Dodge Challenger.
Those have very nice cars in this movie.
Yeah, I'm not really a car person myself, but the cars did look really nice in this movie.
Especially the Falcon that he had.
Oh, yeah.
It's just a shame what happened to these cars. Like in the film, it's like these are treasures now. We need to restore them and put them in a museum, as Indiana Jones would say.
Right.
Exactly. Although I had to laugh, one of the videos I watched a bit from the festival, the other, like they did have like restored some of the cars or at least built replicas of the cars from the film. But then all of a sudden, the Interceptor from Mad Max was there at the festival as well.
I mean, it is another classic car from Australian movies.
Exactly. And yeah, I guess that could be a wrap on this conversation of running on empty. And also, actually, now I remember this, we actually, Richard Moir, who we talked about before, who plays the villain
He's got a
of.
very interesting twist with his acting.
Oh, yeah. Like, he's
Wink,
great.
wink.
Exactly. And I guess for a lot of people, Richard Moir would be probably best known to a lot of people because he played the dad in the first few seasons of Round the Twist. That would probably be where most people would
That's what I
recognize him
was
from.
hinting at, yes.
Yes, well, yes. But also, he has a connection to one of the films we talked about earlier. He was in Heat Wave. He played the main lead in Heat Wave, which is, of course, based on the same true story that The Killing of Angel Street was based on. So
Oh, well, there you go. Interesting.
exactly. But yeah, Marcy, your final thoughts and rating for Running on Empty.
It's not a perfect film, but there's definitely a lot of fun for the most part to be had. And again, the cars and the stunts are very much worth it. And there are some little gem like character moments and characters in there as well. I give it 3.5 Ford Falcons out of 5 that are red, but you should not go tell the blind person they're green. That's very rude.
Yeah, I agree with that. And Pete, your final thoughts and rating for the film?
This is a fun movie. It's definitely worth looking at. Could have been a little bit shorter, but I thought it was really good fun. Enjoyed the stunts, lots of stunts. Watching cars catch fire is always fun, and watching them sort of fall down an embankment like the very first scene. And you sort of think to yourself, well, the next thing is, the car's going to explode, and there it goes. It does. And it was really good. Enjoyed it. I give it 3 degrees of separation out of 5.
Yeah, I give it 3 out of 5 as well. Like, on its own as a film, outside of its reputation being connected to my old hometown of Cobar, I think on its own it is a pretty solid film. Like, it definitely has its flaws. I feel like the script could have used a bit more work, and there's definitely some aspects of the plot that could have been delved into a lot more. But overall, it is still a pretty enjoyable film with some great car scenes, and also the cast do a pretty solid job with their roles. Like I said, I think for me, Max Cullen was kind of the standout with his performance in this film. So yeah, I think it's a pretty solid film overall that if you're a car enthusiast, definitely check it out. It's worth a watch. Moving right along to our fifth and final film, and I guess this would be the big one for this episode. And that, of course, is the classic 1982 action film, Turkey Shoot.
It is 1995.
Open season!
Hunting is the national sport, and people are the prey. The world is ruled by a strict regime.
They're going to make obedient little citizens out of us.
Who are?
Society.
What do you mean?
Step out of line, and they take you to the funny farm. You could die laughing.
All you have to do is lead my guests on a chase for one day. Little sport.
You're going to kill us?
Not necessarily. You might survive.
Is everybody ready?
Come on, you big piece of shit.
You come to me.
I'm the one you can't break. I'm what you've been afraid of all your life.
I'm afraid of nothing.
You're afraid of failing.
This is Thatcher. The hunt is over. Shoot on sight, shoot to kill.
No way.
Quick, please take me with you. Don't leave me here.
The hunters and the hunted. The quick and the dead.
Oh, shit! Oh.
Who will survive the blood and thunder shocker of the year?
Which was directed by Brian Trenchard-Smith, a name we have said many times on this show. It was written by John George and Neil D. Hicks. It stars Steve Railsback, Olivia Hussey, Michael Craig, Carmen Duncan, Linda Stoner, Gus Mercurio, and Australia's sexiest senior citizen, Roger Ward. And the plot summary for this film, which I'm reading off IMDb, is... In a dystopian future where deviants are held in re-education camps, a freedom fighter and an innocent prisoner try to survive their decadent oppressors' game of kill or be killed. Marcy, your thoughts on Turkey Shoot?
See, I knew when I first watched The Most Dangerous Game, it was missing some Aussie action and a lot of camp. And I guess Brian Trenchard-Smith knew that too, because that's kind of Turkey Shoot in a nutshell. It takes a basic premise like that, but it places it in this totalitarian future with the deviants to society locked away in camps for re-education. But there's like the rich folk who run the camps, and then they organize the hunting days where they select their prisoners, you know, to go and hunt and kill. Except, you know, in this case, it actually kind of starts a bit of a revolution at the end. And you know what? I'm happy for them. Good for them. Good for them. This is like a wild, fun ride of a film. It's the kind of film that only Brian Trenchard-Smith could successfully pull off. That the campiness in this film completely sold me. It just sucked me right in, and it was glorious. You know, seriously, major props to the team at Umbrella that drew this for the Blu-ray release, because the film just looks absolutely amazing. Like, it's such a beautiful Blu-ray copy, and it's free to watch on Broly as well if you haven't had a chance to check it out. This is kind of one of those Ozploitation films where we have a mixture of cast. We've got in some international names as well as Australian names to try and, you know, use those names to sell the film. It's got a bit of that, but yeah, if you're making something so ridiculous and you don't have some hint of like camp and fun, I think you're doing a disservice. And this it knows what it is. It goes for it. And I really enjoyed it a lot. And it's kind of weird. Like, this is a very outlandish plot for a film. And you kind of, you think like, oh yeah, it's probably, you know, back then people would think, oh yeah, this couldn't really happen. But I'm looking at just the world today, and I'm thinking, I'm surprised we haven't been put in these camps for being so-called deviants, because the world seriously is so unself-aware of what it does. But anyway, I'm rambling.
Pete, your thoughts on Turkey Shoot?
Well, if I'm ranking my favorite Ozploitation films, I think this one is right up there, probably in the top three, thinking about it today, with Long Weekend and The Man from Hong Kong, which is another Brian Trenchard-Smith film, which I love. This is definitely another Brian Trenchard-Smith magnum opus, and this film has it all, from like the great Roger Ward in his prime playing Michael Craig's right-hand man in a delightfully fiendish performance, to Olivia Hussey, who always looks like she's wondering what the fuck she's got herself into, and then finally Steve Rackman as Alf, who's a strange beast-like creature that has a strange toe fetish. Spoiler alert, he likes to eat them. The movie's like massively over the top. It's super bombastic. At times it's uncomfortably violent, especially the scene early in the film where they burn somebody to death. I don't know. What else can I say? There's some crazy stuff in this movie. Like, there's this great effect at the end we talked about a minute ago with the Thatcher character being shot to pieces, and Brian Trenchard-Smith having that cut in the US version of the movie, and he was so upset with that you can look out for this when you watch Dead End Drive, and he was so upset with them cutting that out. He actually, one of the scenes in Dead End Drive-In where they're all watching movies at the drive-in is they're watching Turkey Shoot, and he snuck in the scene of him being blown apart, and it never got picked up by the censors, and it was in that. He put it in that. So that's a whole reason he put it in there. So great movie. It's a lot of fun. And we've got everyone in this film, like you were saying. It's pretty crazy.
It's such a stacked cast for the kind of film it is, and I love that.
Yeah, it's great.
Yeah, well, with Turkey Shoot, of course, I became aware of this film through Not Quite Hollywood, because it was one of the big main films that they talked about in that doco. And also, when it comes to other Ozploitation films, Turkey Shoot is always mentioned alongside many of the classics that we have mentioned on this show, like Patrick, Razorback, Mad Max, and many others. But what I think really kind of drew me to this film and wanting to watch it is based on the documentary, both in it, but also the critical reception of it. I think at the time, some people considered it like one of the worst Australian films ever made. Even David Stratton, and I quote, condemned the film as a catalogue of sickening horrors, adding that the actors involved should be ashamed for appearing in such trash. You know, he was also among other critics as well who kind of felt the same way. So when I heard that, I'm like, you know, I got to see this movie. So this movie played a part as I think it was the movie classics Ozploitation Day, which I have talked about before. And this was the very last film from the collection they had, and I was very excited. And I got to say, and this also goes into my thoughts on the film even today, I don't know what the critics were talking about. This movie is a lot of fun. Like, it knows exactly what it is. It is very campy. It is very violent. It is very over the top. And it relishes with that. It's a very ridiculous film. That's why I think, like, Maybe critics weren't ready for this type of film back in the early 80s, but if it was released exactly as it is now, I think it would be much more embraced, like especially with how ridiculous of a film it is. I mean, it definitely has a story we've seen many times before, because again, it's that sort of variation of the Most Dangerous Game type of story. But I would say this is definitely up there as one of the best takes outside of the classic original. And also having the cast, it's such a weird cast in this film. And of course, Roger Ward, Australia's sexiest senior citizen, is is great as Ritter, the right-hand man in this film.
He is so vicious and campy.
Yeah, I love it.
Great. Everybody has some sense of camp in their performances. I think maybe the only person who might not have gotten the assignment was Olivia Hussey, who plays it fairly straight throughout. But as I understand it, this was not an easy shoot. It was, I know a bunch of days were lost on the shooting schedule and obviously the locations where it is. I can understand that, and I wish she had lent into some campiness, because I think it just would have made it better, but it is what it is. But damn, is it fun with these ridiculous characters. Oh my God.
Just going to say, if you watch Not Quite Hollywood or any other interview with Linda Stoner, when she talks about this movie, she hates this movie. Like, she's so sorry she was in this movie. She sounds like, from what I've heard, she was an absolute pain in the butt to deal with when they were making the movie. She apparently agreed before the movie, not that I'm saying this is the right thing, she apparently agreed that she would do a nude scene or partially nude scene when she signed up, and then she changed her mind, which is her prerogative, which is fine. But then from apparently that point on, she was really difficult to work with. She was an animal conservationist. So the scene where they're gutting fish, she wouldn't do that. And they had to go away and make fake fish for her to gut and stuff like that. She was quite difficult. But, you know, so that's okay. She didn't like it.
Well, that's the thing. Like, I think even the behind-the-scenes stuff on this film is just as fascinating as what's on screen. Like, even reading some of the stuff that's not even in trivia, like Michael Craig, who plays Thatcher in the film, and obviously that not a very subtle jab at Margaret Thatcher, because that's who the character
and everything, right? So yeah.
Apparently the UK video release retitled the film Blood Camp Thatcher.
It did.
And of course, like, it is not, yeah, like you said, it's so not subtle. Like, we know what you're doing and we're thankful for that.
Although what's interesting though, because the movie bombed here in Australia, but when it was released in the UK and had that title change, it became a massive hit in the UK.
I wonder why. It actually recovered a lot of its losses made because of its UK release. And despite, like, it came out in the UK amongst blizzard season and it still, like, broke records and stuff and made them a lot of their money back.
That's insane. And
it's insane. It really is.
But also, like I was saying about Michael Craig, in his memoirs, he was annoyed by Steve Railsback because Steve Railsback was full on method in this movie, and he found it so annoying.
Well, Steve Railsback, when he was making this movie, the scene where he's in the cage thing and they got the weights and they take stones out to make the weight heavier, he actually made them make that so it actually worked. So when he was shooting that scene, he was actually under duress from the weight, and apparently Michael Craig was getting the shits with him because he was having trouble getting his dialogue out because he was holding these things up. So.
Yeah, it's interesting, but like I said, I think the cast do pretty good in their roles. Olivia Hussey definitely is the weak link of the cast, because obviously, like, her not having such a great time making this movie definitely hinted her performance, because I did find her line deliveries were just didn't feel right with her character. But I will say, though, the performance that, I mean, outside of Roger Ward, who's great in this movie, I also forgot that Gus Mercurio is in this movie as one of the other henchmen.
And he narrates the trailer.
Yeah. And we have discussed Gus Mercurio on this show many times before, because he's also Paul Mercurio's dad, so bringing that little tidbit back out once again. But Also, I think the one performance that really stood out for me in this film was Carmen Duncan. She was, her character, she was relishing playing this really evil character with, as Jennifer, this depraved aristocrat who just goes around in it hunting people with a crossbow, and even with some of the crossbows having explosions on them.
She was the worst shot with with that crossbow. Like, oh, I'm going to savor this experience. No, you're a shit fucking shot. Give it up, woman.
They're all bad, actually.
They were terrible. You rich pricks, I'm going to go hunt the humans. Well, you shit. Fuck off, mate. This is why rich people should not fucking be in charge of anything. Just because you got a lot of money because your daddy fucking earned it the hard way doesn't mean you know shit. So get the fuck out. I agree with what this movie has to say. Marcy's on a rant right now. I'm going to shut up there.
And that, ladies and gentlemen. And that, ladies and gentlemen, was Marcy's soapbox for this episode. Yeah,
I think you're going to need an Ozploit cast disclaimer.
Well, it's the Ozploit cast. We have a few disclaimers on this show, but that was my TED Talk. Thank you.
We apologize to all rich people who like to hunt other people for this episode.
I don't. I know what they're like. You wanna hunt people? You come and hunt me. We'll see how well that goes.
Ooh, there's fighting words. But Pete. They are.
I was just going to say, Olivia Hussey was one of those people that you always see online that is like, thinks that every animal in Australia is going to kill you. And this was part of the problem they had with her, was keeping her in the bush. And she was so afraid of spiders and snakes and whatnot that that she was, you know, obviously it was impacting her acting. I also found out today that the scenes where Olivia Hussey and Steve Railsback are going through like the swampy area, just before they shot those scenes, they actually had reports of a croc in that area, and they were trying to flush it out with explosives, but they were flushing it out in such a way that it moved up towards where they were filming. And they had to walk through, they had to go through all this thinking that thing was around. And then apparently some ranger turned up and said, oh, look, there's a female croc, which is a croc that we're talking about, that had just laid eggs around here. So obviously it's going to be protective of eggs. And it's like, oh, my God.
That's even worse.
Yeah. I don't know if they told Libby Hussey. I would have kept that quiet and just had a few guys around with guns, maybe, you know.
Yeah, we like downplay it. We're like, get real, like, you're gonna be fine. It's all good. And then the brown snake or whatever just shows up randomly. Yeah, whatever, it's cool. If he bites you, you die. Don't stress.
she nearly cut off Roger Ward's hand for real, too.
Yeah, I was just about to mention that in the scene where she cuts off the character's rooted's hand. And I forgot, like, this movie is very violent because we've talked a lot of violent films on this show, Marcy, but I think this film might actually be the most over-the-top violent film we've done for the show. I thought, like, because I remember even that was one of the reasons it had a bit of a backlash from critics because it was so violent. And I think they said it was the most violent film that Australia had made up to that point. And I thought, maybe that's a bit of exaggeration, but then when I rewatched the film again in prep for this episode, I'm like, you know what? Based on all the other Ozploitation films we've covered on this show, I think they actually have a bit of a point.
We've done Nightmares yet?
Yeah, we did Nightmares a couple episodes back, and I would say, yeah.
And wait till you get to Body Melt, like I mentioned before.
Exactly. But yeah, like it's interesting about this film, like, the behind-the-scenes stuff on this film could easily be its own documentary. And I think there is on the Blu-ray that Umbrella released. But yeah, like so much happened on this film. And there's like so much like trivia on this film. Like I'll read some of the ones that we have
there's
here.
There's way too much trivia on the film. So it was very hard to try and condense ones that...
I didn't even need to watch this movie today because I've done this movie for my own podcast. So I've done all the deep dives, et cetera, but I just wanted to watch it again. So.
And also, like, the nude extras in the group shower scene were from a local hippie commune, probably the same one that's from Goodbye Paradise, because I'm not joking. If you got the ending of Turkey Shoot, and the ending of Goodbye Paradise mash them together, I don't think you could tell which movie was which.
You almost switch the reels, right, in the cinema. Yeah.
Exactly. I might have to test this theory at some point. So, but yeah, it is a lot of fun. And like I said, the violence is pretty gruesome, but over the top. So it feels very cartoonish.
It's very cartoonish. It's very campy, but at times it's still brutal, but it feels like it just had the right sort of blend of things that, yeah, it's brutal, but fucking hell.
Oh, it's a romp.
I kind of enjoy like watching this fucking movie.
I love it. I could watch it again tonight easily.
Oh, for sure. It's very easy to watch and get into, especially if you enjoy like all of these elements and stuff. It's one of a kind. It's, as I said, it's the kind of film only Brian Trenchard Smith could make.
Definitely. But I think one other thing I want to sort of mention is, like, we talked about Thatcher's death, which is a great death, by the way, with his head exploding and everything like that. But the death that I found the most awesome was actually Jennifer's death, where Olivia Hussey just froze that arrow with the explosive on it in her mouth, and her head just like burst into flames.
It's like, how come her shot was fantastic, but all through the movie that lady who's trained in doing that was so shit?
They're rich people, Marcy. They think they can do things. So
we already had that rant.
Yes, we'll leave it at that. There's also some stories in. I actually watched it with a commentary today that I hadn't heard before, and it was Mark Hartley and Anthony Ganane, and they were talking about the movie again because there's all these stories about when they were shooting at the characters, they were actually shooting real bullets at people. I think Anthony Ganane kind of saying, well, I'm not sure it's 100% true, but I think they were shooting like almost like, you know, like pellets at them. And some people were actually hit with them. So it's quite quite uncanny how they were doing all that.
You know what, Pete? It's funny you should mention that, because I think in one of the scenes where Steve Railsback is shooting a gun at one of the henchmen, there was a point where he's like up against a wall, and I saw the wall kind of explode a little bit. And it wasn't like the normal kind of explosion you would see with squibs or pretend gunfire and surroundings. That looked like somebody shot a real bullet at him. But being that it is pellets, that would actually make a lot of sense. But it's also, the making of this movie is incredibly insane.
And I was saying as well that a few people were injured doing this, maybe. And then they were saying that Midnight Spares is where everything stopped, because there was like a death in the making of that movie. Have you covered that movie?
That's going to be covered on the next episode of this show.
So there was a death in one of the crew from that movie, from the Speedway scene. And apparently from that point on, that's when everything got really serious about set safety and stuff like that. And so we're right at the end of that era where pretty much anything goes.
Yeah. Like, certainly things changed through the madness that was the 70s and early 80s.
Yeah.
Like, things changed for the better, because it's not worth risking your life for some cool ass stunt. Come on.
It's not, but there's a certain charm to these movies because they were so seat of the pants, right? Or shot that way. So.
Oh, they look intense and always like just wow, but there are certainly times when you're watching, and this goes for like any of these, like the eras that we've covered on this podcast, that you at the back of your mind, you're kind of wondering, like, was this a stunt where someone may have been killed? And that has come up several times. That just, it shows like it was very dangerous, and this was kind of the attitude that they had at the time.
It's crazy. It's like those guys hanging off the side of the motorbikes and Mad Max taking the film down low, and it's nuts.
Nuts indeed.
And Grant Page being at the center of most of them.
Pretty much.
I'm surprised he wasn't involved with this film, because there was one moment I'm thinking, I wonder if that's Grant Page doing the stunt work for Steve Railsback, but then I realize, oh no, he's not involved. But
quite odd he wasn't, because he was in every Brian Trenchard Smith film pretty much.
Yeah, exactly, exactly. So I was
maybe he was
there.
Busy that day or recovering when they were doing the shoot. I don't know.
Who knows?
Brian Trenchard Smith probably called and was like, "Grant, I'm doing this death stunt scene where you possibly might die. Will you come in and do it today?" And he's probably, sorry, I'm sick that day.
I don't know. I think it might be the other way with Grant Page, right?
Well, that is true. That is true. But I guess that could be a wrap on this conversation of Turkey Shoot. Marcy, your final thoughts and rating on this movie?
I give this 4 Dangerous Games out of 5. It's a riot of a film. It is quintessentially Brian Trenchard Smith. And if it's wrong to have a good time with a movie called Turkey Shoot, then arrest me, because it's a lot of fun. It's just it's of an era of this just genuine, like, crazy filmmaking that they wanted to make entertainment and say something, and they went for it. So again, if you haven't seen it, it is available on Blu-ray, but also, as I said earlier, if you're in Australia, Broly has it available to watch for free.
And Pete, your final thoughts and rating on the film?
I think everyone knows what I think about this movie. I love it. It's really good. Worth watching. Like Mike Marcy said, there's a Blu-ray, there's Broly. It sometimes pops up on Prime as well. I've seen it pop up on Prime before, a few other places. So if you're overseas, that's probably a good place to watch it. Yeah, fantastic movie. Like I said, I could go and watch it again now and be quite happy. So I'll give it 4.5 Nord Toes out of 5.
If I had to give this one a rating, I'd give it about 3.5 out of 5. Like, it is, compared to other Brian Trenchard Smith films, there's definitely a little bit of a sloppiness to it, but at the same time, that's what makes it such a fun experience compared to the previous films that he's done, because this film almost looks like it's about to collapse at any moment due to the behind-the-scenes troubles that it was having. But it is a really fun film that's full of great action set pieces, some great gore, some over-the-top violence, and also just some really fun, entertaining, cartoonish performances from most of the cast. And it doesn't surprise me at all that this one's considered a classic among exploitation cinema. It's just a fun ride from beginning to end. And it's definitely better than what critics thought of it at the time, for sure. But yeah, I guess that could be a wrap on this episode of the Ozploit Cast. And thank you again, Marcy, for always being a very awesome co-host.
You're welcome, sir.
And also thank you, Pete, for coming on the show and talking about all these films with us.
Absolute pleasure.
Well, you're always welcome to come back anytime, Pete. So even though, yeah, you may have to go through another 5 films, but you know.
It was hard work, but I got there.
Exactly.
Definitely possible ideas for future episodes of your podcast if, you know, something pops up that you want to take a deeper dive into.
So. It's interesting. I know you guys have done it. I'm going to give myself a plug, sorry. Next episode we've got coming, it should be out on Monday, Tuesday, is Alvin Purple and Alvin Rides Again. We had a hoot watching those. They were better than I thought they were going to be. I'm not sure you think much of them, but I
much preferred Alvin Rides Again, and you can go back and listen to that episode where we covered it and I explain in great detail why that is. Yeah. But Pete, where can people find your podcast or find you on socials or, you know, support your podcast and all that jazz?
Thank you for that. Well, they can find me, they can just search for A Dingo Ate My Movie anywhere where they find podcasts, so Apple, Spotify, etc. You can find me at dingomoviepod.com. You'll find a whole link to all my episodes and everything. There you can find me at Dingo Movie on Twitter. I'm on Facebook. You just look me up. The people on Facebook, when I run ads, sometimes abuse me for the name of my podcast, but who cares? That's always interesting conversation. But yeah, you can find me all over the place. So feel free to come looking and listen.
And Marcy, where can people find us on the internet this week, and also yourself too?
You can find the Ozploit Cast on all the major podcast streaming platforms. Make sure you look up the Ozploit Cast. We are also on supermarcy.com, and you can always listen to the podcast that way. If you would like early access to the podcast, you can sign up to the Patreon at patreon.com/thesupernetwork, and you can find the Super Network on all your main socials, and the handy link tree /thesupernetwork will give you all of that good stuff. And I'm essentially Super Marcy everywhere. I'm Super_Marcy on Letterboxd, and you can get a preview of all the Ozploitation films we will be watching and some of my ratings and thoughts and lists and all that good stuff. And of course, if you want to tune into After Dark with Super Marcy, an adults only podcast, you can find that on all your podcast streaming services everywhere. And of course, you can just find all that stuff on my socials as well.
And if people were to find me personally out there on social media, you can follow me on Twitter, Blue Sky, and Letterboxd under B Jemine as one word. You can also find all my work and all the other podcasts that I co-host with Super Marcy over at supermarcy.com, and as well on the podcast feed, The Super Network, on all podcast streamers everywhere. And also you can listen to my solo podcast, Bede versus the Living Dead, and as well as the spinoff show, Bede and Steve versus Camp Crystal Lake, on all podcast streamers everywhere via the Bede versus the Living Dead podcast feed. So, yep, that is a wrap for episode 14 of the Ozploitcast. We hope you all enjoyed this one, and be back next month for the show for episode 15, in which we'll be talking about the films Attack Force Z, A Dangerous Summer, Freedom, Next of Kin, and Midnight Spares. So stay tuned for that one, everyone, and we'll see you all next time. See you, everybody. Bye. Why you